This year, really, I was inspired to do this because Ray Kropotkin at the Bayit decided that he wanted to have a series on movies and Judaism, something like that. I think he called it Real Life versus Real Life, with the something like that, which I was a bit scared of. It's not something I normally do. So I'm giving the fourth lecture in that series this week on Lord of the Rings and in the Torah, and we'll see how that one goes. I'm not sure, right, Georgina, I thought it'd be interesting to do the same thing with the story of Pesach, because here it's actually much easier to figure out what to do. There's sources over here, Marsh. There's sources over here. Because you know the story of the Exodus from Egypt is one of the most exciting stories ever told, and Hollywood has picked up on that time and time again. So whether it be the classic, the Ten Commandments, or it be the Prince of Egypt, the cartoon version, or the most recent Exodus, Gods and Kings, which was 2015, I think, something of that. Which I am in the middle of watching now to get a feel for it. Hollywood has come to this story many times. And what's interesting is it's not just that you can use the movies to sort of imagine the story, but this is something we'll talk about a little bit more next week. The movies actually function as midrash. Because, you know, what is midrash? Right? Midrash has many functions, but one of its many functions is it fills in gaps. It fills in gaps in the story, and it highlights ambiguities, and it tries to imagine what to fill in those spaces. And I'm going to show this clip, I think, next week. But I don't know if you remember, but before the movie actually starts on the Ten Commandments, there's a prologue. There's an introduction. Right? And the narrator comes out and he says, it might be weird for me to be coming out before the movie starts, but the reason I'm doing it is because there's a 30-year period where we don't know what happens to Moses from when he's taken by the daughter of the Pharaoh into the palace, and then he reemerges to see his sons, and therefore we've had to draw on external sources, on Josephus, on Philo, to try to fill in the story. And especially in the Ten Commandments, The producers, directors, screenwriters, they weren't just trying to capture the story, they were actually engaged in midrash, engaged in trying to interpret the story, fill in the gaps, and try to figure it out. So when we look at the movies, we watch the movies, it's not just, you know, a way of visualizing the story, it's actually a way of staking out positions and taking interpretive positions in terms of what actually happened in the story, because the story is ambiguous, right? If you think about how long the story takes from the beginning, depending on when you start at the beginning, but if you start at the beginning at, let's say, I don't know, if you start it when the Jews become slaves until they go free, you're talking hundreds of years. But even if you talk from the birth of Moses, right? How old is Moshe when we actually get to the Exodus, when we get to Yetziat Mitzrayim? The Torah tells us he's 80. Right? So at least we're talking 80 years that's covered in, you know, a few hundred verses. It's not so much. So to fill in the story of what their lives actually look like, you've got to use your imagination. Midrash does that, the movies do that no less. And at least in the case of the Ten Commandments, they actually based themselves on Midrashim and Josephus and Philo and early sources. Right? They didn't just, some of it they made up, right, and sort of interpreted themselves. Sometimes they didn't. So my goal is to try to force ourselves to understand the story we know so well, and the movies we know. You know, I don't know how many of you actually watched Gods and Kings. And like I said, I've only watched it this week. But the other two, right, most of us have seen either all or parts of the Ten Commandments and the Prince of Egypt. The different stage of Prince of Egypt came out when I was a kid. So that, you know, I had...
Is it called Gods and Kings or God and Kings?
I think it's Gods and Kings. I have to look. I think playing on Rex, it's, you know. So throughout the few weeks, I'm going to be taking different incidents, different parts of the story, and try to see it through different lenses from different movies, and try to understand really what they're getting at. What is it? What light does it shed on the story, on the nature of the Exodus? So next week we're going to do more complicated. I wanted to try with a sort of a easier one. Next week we'll actually sort of, you know, probably the biggest narrative gap that all three movies play up on is, How did Moses grow up? Right? Did he grow up really as the Prince of Egypt? Did he know he was Jewish? Did he not know he was Jewish? When did he discover he was Jewish? When did all that happen? Right? All that is a huge question mark in the Torah. We don't really know. And therefore, all the movies, to different extents, play up on, you know, did he have a good relationship with Ramses II? Did he have a bad relationship with Ramses II? Were they competitive before? Did they already hate each other? Were they already suspect of each other? Did he know he was Jewish? Did he suspect he was Jewish? Did he think he was Egyptian? Right, all those questions. Right? The movies spend hours and hours and hours trying to figure out, which is why I left it, because I think that's a bit more complicated. I wanted to start with a simpler one, even though it's later in the narrative. But it's a bit simpler. So the scene I want to take today, just to read the verses, and then we'll get to the clips, is when Moses first approaches Pharaoh. Right, we're going to jump around a little bit in the story week to week, but I think that's okay because we all know the story. So I took the liberty of doing that. But God tells Moses, I want you to go to Pharaoh. I want you to tell him, let my people go. I want you to get us out of Egypt. Now, if I was God, right, it's a thought experiment there, right, and I wanted to take the Jews out of Egypt, I would have said, look, go get the Jews out of Egypt, and he will say yes, right, or he'll say yes quickly, right, because if your goal is to get the Jews out of Egypt, so then just do it, right, you're God, you can do whatever you want, just go ahead and do it. But God doesn't say that. God tells him the opposite, right? He says, but I will harden Pharaoh's heart. This is the first source. That I may multiply my signs and marvels in the land of Egypt. Right? I'm going to harden his heart. And then we're going to have to come back to this strange phrase. So that I may multiply my signs and marvels in the land of Egypt. Right? Why am I doing that? Right? Because I want to show miracles. So we're going to have to figure out why. And he says, when Pharaoh does not heed you, I will lay my hand upon Egypt and deliver my ranks, my people, the Israelites, from the land of Egypt with extraordinary chastisements. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand over Egypt and bring out the Israelites from their midst. And God tells him, it's not going to be easy. I'm going to have to force his hand. I'm going to have to punish him. I'm going to have to terrify him. I'm going to have to twist his arm until he actually lets you out. So with this confident introduction to his mission, Moshe goes, and he meets his brother on the way, which it only hit me preparing this series that according to the text of the Torah, the text of the Torah says that God tells Moses, you know, you're not comfortable about speaking, so don't worry, I will send your brother, and he will be your spokesman. Right? And he'll meet up with you, and he'll be very happy. According to the text of the Torah, when did he meet Aaron for the first time? Presumably at that moment, right? You know, we're so used to them being brother, right? The three siblings taking us out of Egypt. But according to the simple read of the text, it only hit me watching the movies. He never met Aaron before. He didn't know his brother. The first time he meets him is when God says, by the way, you have a brother, and he's going to help you on this mission. Right? Which is, it's, you know, I always think like, oh, you know, that gives him comfort. No, it's the long-lost brother thing. Right? You've never, according to the, now that's why the movies all try to figure out, when did he meet Aaron? When did he meet Aaron? They all come up, they all imagine different ways of when he met Aaron. But why are they imagining different ways? Because we have no idea when they met, right? We have absolutely no idea, which never hit me until you watch the movie, because you see three different movies trying to figure out when they met, three different ways, and you realize, right, it highlights that there's an interpretive gap, right? There's a narrative gap that is being filled, right? This is the type of thing I want to sort of explore in the next few weeks, right? Not just use the movies as jumping boards, but realize that they're engaged in Midrash. They're trying to fill gaps. And when all the movies try to fill something in, that means there's a gap. Right? Now, we may not accept any of their answers, but analyzing the questions they're trying to answer, and maybe agreeing with their answers, maybe not, right, helps us understand the stories we've known since we were little kids. But so this famous moment, he meets Aaron, presumably for the first time, and so he goes and he says as follows: "The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'When Pharaoh speaks to you and says, produce your marvel, you shall say to Aaron, take your rod and cast it down before Pharaoh. I shall turn it into a serpent.' So Moses and Aaron came before Pharaoh and did just as the Lord has commanded. Aaron cast down his rod in the presence of Pharaoh and his courtiers, and it turned into a serpent." Now stop right there. What do you expect to happen? Right? Moses, come. What would happen right now if I came in and I threw down my pencil and it turned into a spitting cobra, right? And I said, "God has sent me," right? You know, I would have expected
fear.
At least be impressed, right? At least be impressed, right? You know, that's definitely a better trick than anything I've ever done, right? And you'd think, look, God said he's going to give him miracles to convince Pharaoh. And then what happens? Then Pharaoh, for his part, summoned the wise men and the sorcerers and the Egyptian magicians and turned to the same with their spells. Right? God Almighty sent Moses, said, "I'm going to give you the tools that you need to get the Jews out of Egypt." And then it turns out that what he does can be replicated. Right? You think, Moses thinks he's going to impress everybody. And we'll see it in just a minute, right? Moses is convinced this is going to impress everyone. It's going to add credence to the claim that he came by God. And then, as he's expecting everyone to be impressed, big deal, gets replicated. "Each cast down his rod, and they turned into serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed their rods." It's a little bit more impressive, but only mildly, marginally more impressive. Okay, I can turn into snakes, you can turn into snakes, my snake's a bit more aggressive than your snakes, but okay. "Yet Pharaoh's heart stiffened, and he did not heed them as the Lord had said." So this is the scene that I want to analyze. And I want to analyze two things primarily. One is the local question, which is, how did they manage to replicate this miracle? And the second question is, however it is they managed to replicate it, why did God allow them to replicate the miracle if his goal is to convince them to let the Jews out of Egypt? But those are the two questions I want to analyze. So, first, let's see how this scene is portrayed in the Ten Commandments. Okay, let's get it.
"The kingdom of the Most
Loud enough? No? Okay, I don't know how to make it. Okay, this is the loudest it can be on this, so let's see if there's more volume on this.
There was words in it.
What?
I think there were words.
So. Oh, here we have volume here. So we do this.
"What gifts do you bring? We bring you the word of God."
Not loud enough.
It's good.
"What is this word? Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go. Slaves are mine. Their lives are mine. All that they hold is mine. I do not know your God, nor will I let Israel go. Who are you to make their lives bitter in hard bondage? Men shall be ruled by law, not by the will of other men. Who is this God that I should let your people go? Aaron, pass down my staff before Pharaoh, that he may see the power of God. In this you shall know that the Lord is God."
Nothing of his will belong to Marissa.
scorpions and serpents, but God made it a rod to rule over kings. Hear his word, Ramses, and obey. Obey? Moses, Moses. Are there no magicians in Egypt that you have come back to make serpents out of sticks? Or cause rabbits to appear? I will give your staff a greater wonder to perform. Bear it before your idol people, and bid them make bricks without straw.
How can people make bricks without straw?
Let his staff provide them with it. Or let them glean straw in the fields for themselves. But their tally of bricks shall not diminish. So let it be written. So let it be done.
Okay, so this is the way it's portrayed in the Ten Commandments. Now, the Ten Commandments tries very hard to stick to the text of the Torah as much as possible. So it's actually very helpful in illustrating what's going on. So watch the scene. There's a few things that are ambiguous in the movie as they are in the text of the Torah. So I'll throw some of them out. First of all, when the Egyptian magicians replicate the miracle of Moses, is it real magic or is it sleight of hand? We have no idea, right? We have absolutely no idea, right? It maintains the ambiguity of the text, right? Right? We don't know. We just know they replicated. That's all we know. Now, what else is sort of telling about this scene? Moses comes in, and what is he convinced is going to happen after he changes the stick into the snake?
They'll yield,
right? And even after the miracle, right? Even after they replicate it, right? What does he say? You gave me this staff to rule over scorpions, and God has given it to me to rule over kings. Right? He's still convinced that the marginal benefit of his miracle over theirs is going to sway Pharaoh. Right? He's still convinced that Pharaoh is going to be convinced.
Is there anything in
the Torah
that says that his serpent ate their serpent?
Yeah, yeah. It's here. It's in verse 12. Right, each cast down his rod, and they turned into serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed their rods. Right, they try to stick very carefully to it. Right? And Moses is still convinced that the marginal benefit of his miracle over their miracle is going to be enough to persuade Pharaoh. But right, it's not. Right, it's very much not. Right, instead, what does it do? What? Right, instead, he just thinks they're playing games, and he says, right, I will increase your workload, which is what he does, right? As he said, if you're asking for freedom, you must be lazy. So, now, right, try to make the same bricks with the same amount of straw. And by replicating the miracle, right, you see that here, not only is Pharaoh not impressed, right? Ramses is not impressed. Who else isn't impressed? The kid, right? His wife, for sure, right? But also his son, his little son, right, goes and kicks Moses' staff. Right? The movie is very much trying to make it clear that Moses thinks, even till the end, Moses is convinced that he has impressed Pharaoh, and no one's impressed, and I think even more than that. It's not only that he's not impressed, right? There's a moment in it where it seems like Egypt is impressed. But what happens after Pharaoh cynically makes fun of Moshe's miracle? They're all, right, they dig their heels in, right? The humor, right, that sort of laugh, that derisive laugh, right, they're less convinced than they were before the miracle, that Moses has anything on them. Yeah?
In fact, they position themselves to humiliate.
Exactly.
So it's even a little more than I'm not impressed.
Exactly, right? It's the opposite of what, right, Moses was, right? What Moses thought was happening, right? He thought he was impressing them. Not only is he not impressing them, right? The fact that they could replicate it only, right, only weakens his position such that it's not just that Pharaoh kicks him out. He kicks him out and says, you know what, I'm going to use this as an excuse to increase the slavery. They're all laughing. He's the laughing stock of the valleys, right? You almost feel like Nefertiti feels bad for him because of their, right, their pre-existing emotional relationship. Right? She wants to comfort him. It's an embarrassing scene, right? And he walks out like stone-faced. So the questions I want to ask is first, okay, well, how did they replicate it? And then, as I said, the bigger question is, why does God set it up so that it looks like this? Why does it look like this? Okay, so first the smaller question. How do they replicate this miracle? So in order to answer that question, we've got to figure out, is there such a thing as magic? Right? We got two options here. Either they replicate it through magic or they replicate it through sleight of hand. Is there such a thing as magic? So this is an old dispute, but it starts in source 2. The Torah in Dvarim, in Deuteronomy, says as follows. There's a prohibition against performing magic. Let no one be found among you who consigns his son or daughter to the fire, who is an augur, a soothsayer, diviner, a sorcerer, one who casts spells, or one who consults ghosts or familiar spirits, or one who inquires of the dead. For anyone who does such things is abhorrent to the Lord, and it is because of these abhorrent things that the Lord your God is dispossessing them before you. You must be wholehearted with the Lord your God. So the Torah prohibits any Jew from engaging in magic of any sort. Right? Magic, necromancy, soothsaying, all different forms of magic. But what is the nature of that prohibition? Right? Does that mean there is magic and you can't do it? Or does it mean there isn't magic, but you can't pretend to be performing magic because, right, it allows you to represent yourself as the divine, to lead people astray towards idolatry and the like? So this is a dispute. Maimonides in 3, in the Mishnah Torah, in the laws of idolatry, of foreign worship and customs of the nation, writes as follows. He says, all of these things are false and spurious. And it was with such that the ancient idolaters misled the people of many lands so that they be following them. And it is unbecoming to Israel, who are exceedingly wise, to be attracted by these absurdities, nor to even imagine that they are of any consequence. Even as it is said, for there is no enchantment with Jacob, neither is there any divination with Israel. And it is again said, for these nations that thou art to dispossess, hearken unto soothsayers and unto diviners. But as for thee, the Lord thy God hath not suffered thee to do so. Whoever believes in these matters and their like, and suppose that there is wisdom and truth in them, save that the Torah disallowed them, such are none other save from among the foolish and ignorant. Right, so Maimonides takes a very clear position. He says, all these prohibitions don't exist. I mean, they don't exist. All these are not real. The prohibition isn't to actually perform magic. There's no such thing as magic. It's just foolish to believe there's magic or powers or anything like that. There's nature and there's God, and that's all there is to it. There's no dark magic, no, right, no Harry Potter, no, none of that. It doesn't exist. It's not possible. Why does the Torah prohibit it? Because what did idolatrous priests do? Right, sleight of hand, which they passed off as magic. Right, now, in this one, it's not clear, it's ambiguous. But in some of, we'll see in a minute that right, some of the movies take this position very strongly, that this is all fake. Now, but why, right, why was it prohibited? Because the idolatrous priests used to pretend to be divine by performing magic tricks. And therefore, Maimonides said, God prohibited any Jew from engaging in sleight of hand, that he will sort of, will make this a bit ambiguous, but sleight of hand that he passes off as magic. Let's put it that way. Okay? Right? Because much of the modern literature in halachic authorities has gone to the question, okay, if the Rambam is right, then why are we allowed to have magic shows? Right? And the general assumption, without getting to all the details, has basically been, well, even if you think the prohibition is sleight of hand, it's sleight of hand that's being passed off as magic. Right? But nowadays, everyone knows it isn't magic. In fact, right, everyone's game is to figure out how did he do that, right? How did she do that? Sometimes they'll even explain one trick, right? Or they'll, right, you know, or they'll have a YouTube clip where they explain one trick to try to show you how good they are at sleight of hand. But everyone knows it's sleight of hand, so no one's being led astray, and no one thinks that, you know, you're the magician you got for your 5-year-old grandchild's birthday party is starting a new religious cult, right? You know, with their around rabbits in hats and whatever, right? And whatever streamers they pull out of their mouth or whatever it is they do, right? No one's starting a new cult. But in the time of, you know, the pharaohs, they indeed were, right? They really, really were. So the Rambam just, yeah, Maris.
I just say that the Torah seems to treat practitioners of magic like witches, much more severe. I mean, they're to be killed. That's a penalty. I mean, if you're just a regular practitioner of Avodah Zarah, I mean, not... doesn't say
you kill them all. No, you do. A practitioner of Avodah Zarah also is put to death. It's also a death penalty. Death penalty.
And as a Jew, but not a non-Jew.
Nope, death penalty.
Non-Jews.
Of course, it's one of the Sheva Mitzvah Noach. Right, death penalty for idolatry, right? Meaning, but you're right, it's equated with idolatry. It's actually equated with idolatry, right? It's the same, it's on the same sort of spectrum. It's on the idolatrous spectrum, right? We, you know.
But you
are right. You are right.
If you take that to the ultimate, I mean, you can say, I mean, the extent that Gemara thinks that Avodah Zarah, I mean, people who are Christians or believe in the Trinity, there's opinions that, I mean, we don't go out and say, okay,
Correct, and that gets very complicated. The status of Christianity, idolatry nowadays, and
I don't think if there's a Sanhedrin that they
That's a share for another time. I can send you the link to my share on that for another time. But that is a discussion for another time. But it's clear that the Torah is viciously opposed to idolatry of all sorts, right? And yes, it definitely runs against the grain religious tolerance, which is why I have a shiur online on religious tolerance, trying to square it in the square that circle in the land of Israel. But I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you afterwards. Yeah.
It says that it's against the law, you know, to be a soothsayer, diviner, or sorcerer. So what were the prophets? They were diviners and soothsayers.
So the assumption is no, right? Is anyone who, if you're performing miracles like Moses through God, that's not magic. Magic.
To say that it's from God.
To say it's from God.
I'm doing it from
Correct.
God.
What?
I said anybody can say they're doing it from God.
Right, and that's why the laws of false prophets are very complicated, right? But the truth is, did I put it here? Yes, I did put it here. Look, I did put it here. Okay, since you bring it up, I'll skip to it now, right? But skip to 14, all the way to the last source, okay? The Rambam says in the foundations of the Torah, Moses, our master, was not believed in by Israel because he delivered tokens. For whosoever bases his belief contingent upon tokens, he means miracles, right? Retains suspicion in his heart. For it is possible that the token was delivered by means of enchantment and witchcraft. But all the tokens delivered by Moses in the wilderness were responsive to necessities, and not as testimony for prophecy. Wherein then did they believe in him? In being present at Mount Sinai, for his own eyes saw and not through a stranger's. Right, the Rambam says exactly what you said. He said, you know what? Once there is other magic going on, real or fake, anybody can perform miracles and claim it's from God and they have a message from God, or claim that they have a message from God to violate the Torah, or claim that they have a message from another God, or anything. And the Rambam therefore says, he makes a very bold claim and a broad, sweeping claim that the point of miracles is never to prove that you represent God. The point of miracles is to perform a function. Right? So like Eliyahu, right? Elijah performs miracles left, right, and center. Right? But they're never to prove that he's a prophet. Right? He stops the rain to prove that the Jews of the time worship Baal, who was the rain god. So it was to prove that God provides rain and not Baal. Right? He brings the boy back from the dead because he owes the mother, right, that supported him, right? So he brings back the boy from the dead, but he does it for a function, right? And the Rambam says the same was true of Moses. He may have performed this miracle and 10 plagues and split the sea and all that. The reason we believe in Moses and allow him to give us the Torah is because of revelation. Right? The Rambam says it's only revelation where, whatever exactly it means, we saw God, right, and we perceived that God was speaking to Moses, that we believe Moses. But if it was just miracles, you're right. Miracles can be recreated by anybody. Right? You never know if it's real, not real. And that highlights sort of the problem, right? Is that, right, the Rambam thinks miracles are fake, but once he says it's fake, or not miracles, magic is fake, but he says, but the truth is you can replicate many miracles through sleight of hand, right? And that's idolatry because it leads people astray. But therefore, once you've said that, it leads to the obvious conclusion that someone who performs a miracle is not going to be totally convinced, or other people won't be totally convinced that it's a miracle, right? There's always doubts lingering, right? And this, right, as you can already see, gets complicated in our story, and that's where we're going to come to. In our story, it's very complicated, because if miracles can always be doubted, then what exactly is Moses doing here? Right? What is the point of this if it's not going to convince anybody? Right? It doesn't even convince us. Right? In fact, the Rambam says, Maimonides says, it's not supposed to convince us. So if it's not going to convince anybody, it's not even supposed to convince anybody, then why is it happening? Right? What is going on here? So hold that thought. Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, I can't remember how often I've seen this movie, and I'm really glad I'm seeing it now, because there's something I saw that maybe I'm wrong, you can help me, that is remarkable. You look at the text. God does not tell Moses, do this in my name. Take your rod, cast it down before Pharaoh. There's no mention of God. Moses came and Aaron cast down his rod in the presence of Pharaoh. There's no mention of God. But here in the movie, he doesn't. He says, exactly. I am doing this in God's name, and it's almost as if Cecil B. DeMille thought that this text was too ambiguous.
That's interesting. Right, because the verses before and after, right, definitely sound like it's deliver my signs, but you're right, the text itself here doesn't. I mean, the earlier conversation does. He does, earlier in the, you know, what's in the ellipsis, is he does introduce himself and say, I'm coming on behalf of God. But you're right, he never says that this miracle is what proves God to you. You're right, he doesn't do that, right? Which is interesting, it could be because...
I think DeMille had a problem. I mean, when you look at it, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's almost as if Moses should have said to God, well, I can't do it your way, because they're the magicians. I know the magicians. They can do this too. I've got to say, I'm here in God's name, and God is doing that. God is doing this. And I think that's what DeMille picked on.
Interesting. It is interesting because he definitely, part of his speech, which is, you know, in the ellipsis, which I didn't put, but he does introduce himself and saying, I'm coming on behalf of God. Right? That he does say, but you're right. At this moment, he doesn't say, and God has sent this miracle. Right? And here he does. No, in the movie he does. But you're right. In the Pesukim he doesn't. Right? Right? It's implied, but maybe it's not. Right? It's interesting.
There's something else in this which I would never have seen, but you stop here. This is fascinating. The background, of course, is the relationship between Nefertiti,
yes,
and Moses, and that she's in this loveless marriage. But Moses walks away from her. The same way as he walks away from Tzipora.
So, okay, I'm going to say this in parentheses because I debated giving a whole shiur on it. We still could, but it's not really the Exodus. Perhaps my favorite moment in the movie, because it's a brilliant midrashic move. It's a midrash, but it is the movie function of midrash, but it's absolutely beautiful. Nefertiti, right here, one of the moves that and maybe we will talk about this one, that the movie makes is that Pharaoh decrees before God that every firstborn child will be killed. Right? That's how the movie Midrash sizes that, right? That says the reason God kills every firstborn is because Pharaoh said it first, and God just fulfills his will, but against him. Nefertiti runs to Goshen, where in the movie Tzipora has actually come with Moshe and Tzipora's child, and says, I've brought a chariot for you to send you back to Midian to save Moses' child, as, you know, out of sympathy for Moses' child. But they're talking there, and Nefertiti is talking about how she has lost, you know, Moses. She was in love with Moses. And the movie, playing on the Midrash, that once Moshe speaks to God, he no longer is intimate with Tzipporah. Tzipporah retorts to Nefertiti, you lost Moses when he went to find his God, and I lost him when he found him. Right? Right? Which is a beautiful Midrashic, right? Midrashic move, which captures, right, this, right? That you know, this whole, or the movie really plays up on that. Yeah, that they're both, and that Moshe sort of leaves, you know, multiple loves in his life, sort of abandoned for God, right?
One more small thing. When you talk about magicians and magic, well, there it is. That's what movies are. They are magic. When they first came out, and I forget what the term was, not CinemaTheks,
whatever it was called, yeah.
Everybody considered it magic. Literally, that was their word. Magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So let's continue here. So now, look. If you look at four, though, there were many who disagreed with the Rambam. The most sort of vehement of them, though, there is question about whether this passage is authentic or not. But either way, it portrays a school of thought. Is that of the Vilna Gaon, Eliyahu Kramer of Vilna in the 18th century, who writes, "All those who came after him disagreed with Maimonides, for there are many incantations mentioned in the Talmud. But he was drawn to philosophy, and that's why he wrote that sorcery and holy names and incantations and demons and amulets are all false." False. But he had already been hit over the head about this, for we have seen many incidents in the Gemara using holy names and sorcery. Philosophy has influenced him, in Maimonides, by the magnitude of its teachings, to interpret the Gemara as analogy and take it out of its plain meaning, God forbid. I do not believe in them, meaning philosophers, or their great numbers. Everything is as it is in the plain meaning, but it contains an inner element, not the inner element of philosophy, which is truly external, but that of the masters of truth." Right? So there is a totally another tradition in Jewish thought that, no, there is magic. There's dark magic, there's white magic, right? When the Torah says don't use magic, it's because it's real, right? And when we say you can perform miracles, it's a question of source. Where's your magic from? Is it white magic from God and Kabbalah and whatever you want? Or is it black magic from demons and whatever exactly it is? But either way, right, in our story, we don't know, right? Is this real, fake? We don't know which one of these it is. And the Ralbag in 5 highlights that, right? The Ralbag tells you that the wisdom was either to perform sleight of hand and bring people to think that they were doing what they were not, or create natural scheme to perform strange things which seem like magic, or do these things through magic if they can perform them through magic, like the true acts that were performed. We don't know the nature of this magic, right? He says, I have no idea. Even if you believe in magic, you don't know whether this is real magic, right? You can believe there is real magic. You still have to ask the question, I don't know whether this is real magic or this is sleight of hand. Now, the Psikta in 6 tells you that they think it was deception. It was just sleight of hand, right? With their incantations, appearing to act but not acting. The deeds of the Khartoumim of Egypt, the magicians of Egypt, were all deception of the eyes. Now, here, you know, this is probably a good time. This, you know, this is this more rationalist position, shall we say, is definitely the preferred position in, you know, let's say, the last 10 years. So in the Prince of Egypt, they very much take the latter position, that this is sleight of hand. So this is that same moment. They've now been asked to replicate it. And you can see they're recreating a show.
Nefertiti, Nachmen, Sobek, Sakmet, Sukkah, Selkah, Rishabu. So you think you've got friends in high places with the power to put us on the run. Well, forgive us these smiles on our faces. You'll know what power is when we are done, son. You're playing with the big boys now.
Sort of not surprisingly, in the more modern one, right? There's no ambiguity. It's fake magic, right? This is a magic show, right? But a few things do become clear, because we said if it is sleight of hand, what is the problem with magic in general? That it leads people to idolatry, right? But here you see that very clear, right? What are they doing? What's the song they're singing? If you catch all the names. Right, by the power of Ra and Horus and right, and all the right,
gods.
Right, all their gods. Meaning, it is the way that they lead people astray. Right, it's making it very clear that this is a deception, but they gain their power by convincing people that they are godly. And the Talmud has a very nice way of putting this in 7. And this is true really for either side, but the Gemara in Sanhedrin describes magic as follows. Rav Evo Bar Nagri says, the Rav Chiya Bar Abba said in the verse, and the magicians of Egypt did in the manner with their secret arts, bilatehem. These words are describing acts of employing demons, which are invisible, and their actions are therefore hidden, balat, with regard to the similar term bilatehem. They are acts of sorcery, which swords perform themselves without using demons, and likewise it said the flaming lot that turned every way, referring to the sword that revolves by itself. Sorry. This Talmudic passage sounds like this magic is real. Right? So you have one, you know, Midrashic passage that is fake, one that it's real, but the ambiguity is the same. But either way, what is the problem, right, of magic? So you skip to 9 for a minute. Rabbi Yochanan says, why is sorcery called kshafim? Because it is an acronym for contradicts the heavenly entourage, shemachishin pamalia shalmala. Sorcery appears to contradict the laws of nature established by God. The verse states, to you who is shown, so that you should know that the Lord is God, there is none else besides Him. Hanina says this is true even with regards to matters of sorcery. Sorcery is ineffective against a righteous person, Reva Bar Nagri, etc., etc., going back to the passage from before. So, right, you have different implications. Is magic real? Is the magic they're doing real? But what's clear, what the Talmud does make very clear, is why is magic problematic, right? If it's real, or even if it's fake, what is it used to do? It's used to contradict heaven. Right? It's machishin pamali shamali. If it's real magic, it means that, you know, there's white magic, but you, instead of using white magic, are using black magic. And even if it's sleight of hand, right, as we've seen here, what is the point of it to strengthen the position of the representatives of idols. So what's the point? Right? If whether there's real magic or fake magic, if the reason magic is problematic, it's either because you're actually tapping into forces that can contradict God, or you can make it seem as if you're able to contradict God, right? Then why in our story does God allow or allow? Why does God encourage Moses to enter into this pointless activity?
Because he's going to show later on that there are things that they can remember.
Ah, good. So hold that thought for 1 second. The Midrash just puts this question very strongly in 8. The Midrash in Shmuel Rabba says as follows. And Pharaoh also called his wise men and magicians. At that moment, Pharaoh began to laugh and cackle at him like a chicken. He said, "These are the signs of your God. Normally, people bring merchandise to a place that needs them. Do you bring fish brine to Apamia or fish to Akko, where apparently these things were common? Don't you know that all the magic is in my control?" He immediately sent for children from their schools. Right? They imagine it's not adults, it's kids. Right? And they did the same. Even more so, he called his wife, and she did the same, as it says, and Pharaoh also called. What does it mean also? That even called his wife, and she did the same. The magicians also did this. What does also mean? Even 4 and 5 year old children were called, and they did this. Right? The Midrash just says, going in, you knew this was pointless. Literally everybody. This was like the national sport was magic. So why do you do it? Why do you do it? So, there are two radically different interpretations that I think one could suggest. So one was just suggested. So say it again, and then we'll take it. Why would we do it, right?
Because later God's going to make miracles that they can't reproduce.
Good. So one possibility is to say this whole thing is part of education. Right? It's part of education. In what sense? Right? Pull them in. Right, make them think they're on equal footing so that they're already in the game, right? And then prove your superiority when you've already dragged them in to the game. Right? If you just come in and you start by, you know, if you come and you just overwhelm people, they just don't process. Right? Get them in the game, make them think that you're just like them, and slowly escalate until you get the moment at which they realize you're different. Right? This is part of education. So, if to bolster that theory, go to 10. Right? This is what the verses say immediately following this incident. And the Lord said to Moses, "Pharaoh is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is coming out of the water and station yourself before him at the edge of the Nile, taking with you the rod that turned into a snake. And say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to say to you, let my people go that they may worship me in the wilderness. But you have paid no heed until now. Thus says the Lord, by this shall you shall know that I am the Lord. See, I shall strike the water in the Nile with the rod that is in my hand, and it will be turned into blood.'" So God tells Moshe, and he tells Pharaoh, what is the plan here? To educate him, to teach him that God is God. But when the Egyptian magicians did the same with their spells, Pharaoh's heart stiffened and he did not heed them, as the Lord had spoken. Pharaoh turned and went into his palace, paying no regard even to this. Right? But Pharaoh doesn't care. Right? God says, my point of my miracles is to educate Pharaoh. But what happens? The blood again. The Egyptians replicate. So what does Pharaoh say? It's another magic trick. Here we go again. And then again with frogs. When does that break down? Kenim, number 3, right? Lice, in number 11. The magicians did the like with their spells to produce lice, but they could not. The vermin remained upon man and beast, and the magician said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." But Pharaoh's heart stiffened, he would not heed them as the Lord had spoken. So one possibility is that The point of this whole thing was to educate. Now, it didn't work for Pharaoh.
Maybe he didn't have to educate him. Maybe he would do it right away at the beginning if God would not harden his heart.
So hold that thought for a second, because that'll be the opposite. Let's... 10 seconds. Right? One possibility is that the point here is to educate. Right? That God is purposely giving him something that became replicated because he doesn't want to overwhelm him right at the beginning. He wants to slowly... Right? That part of the purpose of the Egypt story isn't just to get the Jews out. Right? I mean, this comes back to our opening question. Is why didn't God just overwhelm Pharaoh and kill them all and let us out? Or, easier, why didn't he just fly us out on a magic carpet? Right? And no one has to get hurt. Right? What was the point of smacking the Egyptians every time, time and time again, slowly escalating? So one possibility is that the primary purpose, or one of the primary purposes of the whole process, the Exodus, isn't getting us out. Getting us out, we could have done anyway. It's educating the Egyptians. To educate the Egyptians, right? We all know this, right? You can't start overwhelming them. You start slow. You get them interested, right? You get them, right? You know, it's like you're teaching someone to play basketball. So you start, you know, you're much better than them, but you start by playing easy so they have a little bit of confidence, right? But then you slowly show them how much better you are so that they have something to strive to. They realize, you know, there's a lot more to go. Right? First, you're like nice and calm and you know, you get them into the sport. You get them interested, and then they realize, oh wow, there's a whole other league, and maybe it'll inspire them to change. It'll inspire them to practice. Right? In this case, you can't practice and become God, but the same general idea. The point of Egypt, the Egypt story isn't just to get us out. It's to educate Pharaoh. So what do? You start slow. You start easy. Now, Moses may not have realized this. Right? Moshe may not have known. Moshe may have thought, hey, I'm going to walk in with a miracle, and everyone's going to say, oh, he has miracles, he must be from God. But God never said he would bend after the first one. He said, no, I'm going to send you with something that can easily replicate, even through magic or through sleight of hand, but it'll get them in the game. And they'll keep trying, because they'll keep thinking we're in the same league. And then as soon as it becomes clear we're not in the same league, a light will go off, and they'll say, as they do, that is God. Right? But how did he educate them? He slowly moved it, right? It was easy, then it got a little bit harder, and then it got impossible. And when it crossed that threshold, they realized, oh, we're not dealing with someone in our league, right? So that's one possibility. The other possibility is, say, what's your name again? What's your name again?
Ruhama.
As Ruhama said, the other possibility is literally the opposite, right? This isn't about educating Pharaoh. It's about ensuring that he doesn't say yes, to harden his heart, to give God an excuse to punish him. Right? Another way of reading the whole story is that God wants to punish Pharaoh because he deserves it. Right? He doesn't want him to say yes right away because, you know, the movies also play up on this, right? You know, especially the new one, Gods and Kings, right? Moses there is an advocate for the Egyptians. Why are you being so vindictive? And God speaks to him through a child. It's very strange, but whatever. And he says, me? So this is 400 years already, right? It's not my fault, right? I'm not going to let them get out of this so easily and just let the Jewish people go. There's justice to be reckoned with. Right? This is 400 years in. So the other possibility is literally the opposite. Is that God is giving them a softball so that they can be tricked into thinking that they are God. And then what happens? If you can replicate God the first time, the second time, what do you think by the third time? When you can't replicate it. So you could think, oh, he's in a different league, therefore it's God, and he's right. But you could also do the opposite and say, look, I can replicate the first two, so I can't replicate the third. Big deal. So he's a slightly better magician than me. Right? Maybe I'll go learn from him. But he's not a god, he's just a better magician. Right? If he was so important, why did he start with these things that I could trade? Right? He kept slowly escalating because, you know, he had to keep upping his game. Okay, so he's a better magician than me. Ooh, he's a better magician than me. I'm so scared. Right? Right? So there's two And this is what I think is fascinating, is this small incident where it's clear that God is setting Moshe up to fail forces you to ask the big question. Why does God set him up to fail? Why does God want Pharaoh not to be convinced? It's clear, right? You see both movies. Whether it's real magic or fake magic, right? There was no moment in those scenes when the Egyptians ever thought they were going to be cowed. And if anything, by the time they finish, they're more convinced they're never going to give in. Why would God set Moshe up to fail miserably, so badly that the Egyptians would dig their heels in and be less convinced than they were before he started talking? Right? That's a big question when you think about the story, right? We don't think about it, right? Because we're so used to it. But that's a big question, right? Moses was set up for humiliation. And there's two radically different conclusions you can get to, right? One is that God wanted him to fail miserably so that the Egyptians would never bow until they were punished, right? Until they got what they deserved. So God purposely humiliated Moshe, went out of his way to let them replicate it so that they would never give in until it was too late. Or at the opposite extreme, that no, God set Moshe up to fail because he wanted them to slowly come to the conclusion that he was God. Right? And those are two radically different ways of conceiving the point of the Exodus. Both of them assume, just one second, both of them assume that the point of the miracles is not only to get the Jews out. But they have two. But what is the point then? One is that it's about justice and punishing the Egyptians, they deserve it. The other is saying that no, the Exodus was equally about educating the Jews and helping the Jews as it was about educating Pharaoh. Those are two very different stories, but you're forced to ask it by watching this scene and saying, why did God humiliate Moshe so? And the answer has to be there's something bigger going on. Which of those narratives it is not clear, but it's clear that one of those is present. Yeah?
I was going to say it was about educating the Jewish people as to how this was now going to work. And I think it's a test of faith. It either solidifies the plan and the people with the plan and God. But also I've read several things where God clearly says to Moshe, it's through your challenges that you became great.
Okay, so that is perfect because that was my last point. Right? The third point, right, is that in addition to the whichever narrative you want to take is what is this charade going on for the Egyptians, right? The third point is that it's there for the Jews. Because this was the Rambam I'd said a long time ago. It started with, right? God also wanted to educate the Jews. He knew miracles wouldn't convince the Jews, right? What does the Rambam say? The miracles aren't there to convince the Jews because miracles don't convince. Miracles are there for a reason, right? When did the Jews get convinced? Only at Revelation. Right, that this is part of bringing the Jews on a journey also. Because, right, they're also watching this. They're seeing miracles, but they're seeing miracles being replicated. Which means the Rambam tells you, yeah, because the Jews are also learning that miracles aren't about proving God. Nothing can prove God except experience. Experiencing God, revelation. That's the only moment history will perceive God in any sense directly. We learn about miracles, that miracles aren't impressive. Right, that miracles are only used so that God can do something. Right, that God is sending miracles. He is behind it, but because he wants to help us, not because he needs to prove his existence. Nothing, no miracle will prove his existence. But the truth is that it doesn't fully work. Right, as much as the miracles are supposed to get the Jews buy-in. And slowly they're supposed to be led to the moment of revelation where they realize that, you know, God is totally different. It doesn't work. The Jews always doubt Moshe. And in a beautiful midrashic move, the midrash asks, you know why the Jews consistently fight with Moshe? I don't know if you caught it. In the Ten Commandments, what was the name of the magician? Did you catch it? No. Janus. You know why? Look at, it's from the midrash in 13, the Tanchuma. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down, right, by the golden calf, 40,000 people had assembled to leave Egypt with the Israelites, and among them were two Egyptians named Jannes and Jambres, who had performed magical feats for Pharaoh. You know why the Jews always fight with Moses and are not convinced, and they make the Egel Hazav, they make the golden calf? Because those magicians converted and came along. And those lingering doubts continued, because once, right, on the one hand, performing miracles could convince the Jews that God is with you, and leading the Jews to revelation could convince them that, you know, God is at a different quantum level than magicians. But what the Midrash is saying, even if it wasn't actually the people came along, what's the Midrash trying to tell you? The doubts that are created by having grown up in a culture of magic linger, because it never fully works. As much as God tried to educate the Jews and remove their reliance on miracles and magic and get them to believe in God because of revelation, it doesn't work. Jannes comes with them, right? Or the fears, the doubts that come from living in a culture where everyone can do magic continues with them. And as much as, yes, God may have tried to educate the Jews that magic is not so impressive, right? God is different. Don't try to go back to that idolatrous magic mindset. That's what God is trying to do. But the Midrash tells you it never really works. And in this beautiful Midrashic move, which the movie picks up on, Jannes converts, but he's not a full convert. He ends up coming with them, right? And with him comes this scene, comes this doubt, comes this mocking, the ability to, on a dime, when Moses doesn't show up, when Moshe doesn't come down from the mountain, to go back to what you know, to go back to this. Right? And the movie, picking up on that, is just beautiful. Right, picks up on this Midrash and says, yeah, that remains part of their life going in. And it's those doubts that they never really gain the education. They never really say, yeah, God is different. And they're always still in that idolatrous magic mindset, proves that God needs another generation to bring up a nation in the desert, not in Egypt, to move out of that mindset, to be fully committed to God, because until then, right, this scene is in the background, and the Jews too, unfortunately, never fully get the lesson, which is the last thing the Midrash and the movie tries to leave you with. Okay.